Hi friends. I talk a lot about systems thinking on this podcast and thought I'd share one of the most potent actions you can take if you feel moved to be a different kind of leader for the 21st century. At Small Giants Academy, we developed our answer to the traditional MBA. We call it the MBE, a Mastery of Business and Empathy. The MBE is a truly groundbreaking program which equips leaders with the tools, strategies, networks, and philosophies to lead with purpose in these troubled times. Applications are open now for 2025, so head to smallgiants.com.au/MBE to learn more and sign up.
Biomimicry is a way of solving problems. It's a new way of viewing and valuing nature. It's a lens. The practice of it is literally whenever you're about to create a design or make a decision, because decisions are designs as well, you go into the natural world and say, what in the natural world has already done what I'm trying to do? Because that has been evolved in place and it has embodied wisdom.
Hi, I'm Barry, and this is the Wisdom in Action podcast, brought to you by the Small Giants Academy. Janine Benyus is a biologist, innovation consultant, and author who wrote the seminal book, Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. Since the book's release in the 1990s, she has evolved a practice of biomimicry, introducing designers to the 3.8 billion years of awe-inspiring and time-tested solutions to be found in the living world. Her TED Talk has had nearly 2 million views, and she has founded NGOs and companies like Biomimicry 3.8 to promote nature-inspired innovation and education and bring nature's genius to human design. This conversation was a life highlight for me. I got to talk to one of the truly brilliant minds and hearts alive today, whose work, I believe, should inform every system we live in. We unpack the theory of biomimicry and how to put it into practice in what was a truly moving conversation that I feel very lucky to have had. I'm so thrilled to be able to share it with you all. Janine, it is such a joy to be speaking with you and to share my love of Janine Benyus with the world. And I think for anyone who isn't a nature nerd, I want everyone listening today to understand some of the magic of who you are. So can you share with everyone listening a bit about your story, your journey, and biomimicry, which is what we're here to talk about today?
Growing up outside was really the first education. Now I'm surrounded by wilderness in Western Montana, but I grew up in suburban New Jersey, so you can do this anywhere. And I found micro wildernesses and got to know all those organisms within those places so well, just from being an observational little kid. And I was also a bookworm and loved to write. So I thought, what can I write about? And I thought, I know, life. I'll write about life. So I am a natural history writer, and biomimicry is my sixth book. But all the books before that, they kind of got me here because they are about, they're ecologists' guides to wildlife habitats and animal behavior. And they take you into a place of appreciation for the amazingly well-adapted organisms in our midst. And so the way we experience the natural world is through habitats. We don't experience it. I used to, you know, as a little kid, I would have a backpack full of, like, there was a book of mushrooms and a book of plants and a book of birds. And I was like, but when I go into a marsh, I want a book of marsh. And I want to know all the plants and the insects and the organisms that live there. And I want to know why they live there and not somewhere else. And so I started to write these habitat books that took you to those places and said, here's who lives here and why. And here's why they have the most amazing adaptations in the world in order to live there, in order to live at the bottom of the ocean or on a tidal area or in a mangrove swamp. This is how they live here and how they have co-created this place. So my books were just, it was just years of Plant and animal adaptations, insect, microbe, adaptations to place. How do you live in a place and make it even better? Because if you watch over long periods of time the same place, you realize it's getting more fecund and richer and more fertile, and that the organisms that live there are actually participants in that. And so I had done that for so many years, and then I started to have that existential crisis, which is, you know, Aldo Leopold, the ecologist lives alone in a world of wounds, the one with an ecological education, because what was happening, I was born mid-century-ish, and then that's when the Great Acceleration happened, and all of the things, all of the habitats around us were beginning to be truly, truly frayed.
Which was, of course, mid-century, flagged by the powerful work of people like Rachel Carson. And people often say, you're in that legacy. Janine Benyus carries on the legacy of, you know, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which began to sort of ring the bell of warning for humanity on what we were doing.
Yeah, she's very much my hero, because her book, first book, was published when she was 50. She was a government writer. And I was a government writer. I was working in the Forest Service. And I said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to work until I'm 50 and then do a book. And at 26, I left and started to write these books. Rachel Carson also taught me that she was so fierce, and she overcame her timidity in order to do that which is necessary. And she also taught me that you can put poetry in science writing. Anyway, so this last book, Biomimicry, came out of my question of, well, if all these amazing adaptations, natural technologies, tools for living, well in place, are there, why aren't the people who are making our world looking at them? And I said, surely they must be. So I went, and I'm a nerd. I read scientific articles. At that point, you would go to the library, look at the stacks. And I started to look up, you know, how did solar cells get invented? And I thought, for sure, they worked with botanists who told them how photosynthesis works in the biggest solar endeavor of our planet, which is the green plants and algae and leaves around you. But that wasn't true. In fact, solar manufacturers never worked with, until I found one little paper where there was this group at Arizona State University, and they were studying photosynthesis and trying to make a new kind of solar cell that worked like photosynthesis. And that was, I thought everybody should know about that. But it was a very obscure thing. So I started to collect these papers. And that was back in 1990. Anytime a scientist was studying something amazing in the natural world and then trying to see how to emulate it in our own technologies, I would Xerox it and put it in a folder. And I had to name that folder one day. I named it Biomimicry. Bio means life, mimicry to imitate. And then I got a folder, two folders, three folders, a drawer in a filing cabinet. And then when I walked past the filing cabinet one day and there were four drawers of papers for a field nobody had a name for, I said, oh my goodness, this is my next book. I stopped and I wrote another book to become a better writer because I knew it was important. I knew it was really important. I knew it was an inflection point in our relationship to the rest of the natural world, to be student rather than conqueror. And then I wrote the book. I never really thought it would, you know, natural history writers don't have a big audience. And yet the people who make our world started to call and say, do you have some biologists that you could bring to our design, engineering, architecture, chemistry table, our labs, where we're making the world? Can you bring biologists in? And I said, you know, I'm a writer. But after so many of those calls, I got one call from a young PhD candidate called Dana Baumeister. She had read the book, shook for 3 days, and she said, let's do this. I said, let's do what? And that's how biomimicry started. This could be an emerging discipline. People could actually look to the natural world when they're designing something and emulate what they find.
I love that story so much. You know, one drawer and then four drawers. And that there was a beginning to this this movement that it didn't even have a name. I think that's really important because we're in a time of emerging futures and there are things that don't have names yet that are full of hope and possibility. And that story is an example of that. And it's making me think of two things, but one of the things was I remember a few years ago, Elon Musk, the great tech mind who kind of like is the symbol, is the iconic symbol of a techno future. He tweeted that he would give a $100 million prize to whoever could design a machine that takes carbon out of the atmosphere and sequesters it and then turn it into a secondary fuel. And that tweet went out and the first tweet response to it was like my favorite ever. This guy tweeted back and wrote, what, like a tree?
Exactly. Exactly. We've come that far that that wasn't obvious, right?
Right. And I think that's the bridge. Your work has been this incredible bridge to take us back to our belonging on this planet, to orient ourselves to the R&D, the research and development that has been going on for billions of years on this planet. And we keep looking for life that is alien. You know, we're looking out to the stars, but we've got seahorses on this planet.
Yes, we do. We have miracles. Life is a miracle.
Life is a miracle. Yeah.
It really is. It's miraculous. It's miraculous. It's also living things are the consummate chemists, engineers, physicists. They're good. They're elegant. They're also incredibly good because they've had 3.8 billion years.
I love this orientation of yours. And Danny, my husband Danny, who's an aerospace engineer by training, and he started Engineers Without Borders, he still says that your book, Biomimicry, is in his top five books of all time and will remain there because of how his own brain was already thinking about context. Like, what is the context within which we are assigned problem-solving tasks? And many of us in different fields around the world don't even ask about the context of the assignment. And your work is even deeper than that again. So explain a bit about biomimicry, innovation inspired by nature, and how you teach people and what the book talks about and how biomimicry can help us orient towards nature for these emerging future solutions.
When we decided that we would answer that call and send biologists to the design and engineering table, we had to sort of create a methodology for how you would look into the natural world. And we realized that the bridge between design and biology is function. And Denny would understand this. You know, context is super important to look at what your invention is going to, how where it's going to live. And we always say that the context is the earth, which as an engineer, he would know that, oh my goodness, well, then we need a function that's not just doing whatever we want the gizmo to do, but it also needs to be good for life. It needs to create conditions conducive to life, because at the end of the day, it has to come from earth, it has to live on earth, and it has to, in its next life cycle or whatever, it's got to be good for the earth. And so it's interesting that he has that, we start with context. But we also start with function. We say, what is it that you want your design to do, right? You know, say that you want, you know, your north face and you want to make a tent and you want it to be water repellent. So you want to repel water. And then we biologize that and we say, okay, well, what in the natural world, how does nature repel water or liquid or fluid of any kind? You know, how does repellency work in the natural world? What we do is we write an amoeba through zebra report. Okay, so we go across the tree of life, because that's where it's really amazing to look for those patterns. So 3.8 billion years is how long life's been on Earth. That's been a long time of R&D. But then we go amoeba through zebra. So how do bacteria do it? How do fungi do it? How do plants do it? How do animals do it? How do birds do it? And then you look at all the ways that they do water repellency. And guess what? None of them are forever chemicals that are toxic. None of them are Teflon. None of them have fluorinated compounds in them. None of them. And yet, we go to the inventors and we say, okay, here's, you know, we read through tens of thousands of articles, we pull out these design principles, and then we put them into a taxonomy, all these different ways. And we say, okay, well, some of it is physical, some of it is chemical, again, life-friendly chemistry, and some of it's a combination of that. And then we give the inventor, you know, a kind of very condensed and distilled set of ideas, and the inventors look at them and go to the person, go, oh my God, I have never thought of any of this. You know, we worked with a big company, and they wrote back and said, we have 1,000 PhDs on staff. We've never looked at any of this. And so then we work with the inventors and we say, okay, well, we want to introduce you to the ethos of biomimicry, which is that if you're an organism and you're trying to repel water, you can't do it with toxic chemicals, and especially not forever chemicals, because that would hurt your body. You've got to manufacture it in your own body. The chemistry has to be in water at room temp, your own body. And you have to, at the end of the day, your feathers are going to fall onto the, or your, you know, onto the ground, and you can't, that's where your offspring are going to be. So you can't make them toxic. So, okay, so that's off the table. So we actually say, that's one of our life's principles, life-friendly chemistry.
It feels like the crisis around us are building and we're scrambling for ideas. We're looking to the geniuses to solve our energy crisis, our food crisis, the crisis of war, our social foundation. And everyone's trying to be clever, but nobody actually knows how to build a hopeful future. And you said that you're surrounded by genius.
We all are. Biomimicry is a way of solving problems. It's a new way of viewing and valuing nature. But it's not a body of work, right? It's a lens. The practice of it is literally whenever you're about to create a design or make a decision, because decisions are designs as well, you go into the natural world and say, what in the natural world has already done what I'm trying to do? Because that has been evolved in place, and it has embodied wisdom of living well in place, the context of everything we do, right? And life has managed to meet their needs. These organisms meet their needs. They do it in a way that actually creates conditions conducive to life. So it's not that they don't meet their needs. They do. And one of the things I think that, you know, people say, why haven't we done this? Well, indigenous people have always been doing this. And we got away from it in Western industrial culture because, you know, we were very impressed with our own abilities, right? We're this young species, and a very brainy one, but a very young species, 200,000 years versus 3.8 billion years, right? We're toddlers with matches compared to these organisms.
I don't want to be too mesmerized by how we got here, but I feel like you're describing the hubris of human beings is tied in with the stack of things that got us here, a sort of dominance mindset, a competition mindset, and a sort of we're bewitched by our own cleverness. Because I think that the idea of man getting to the moon, that engineering cleverness, is thrilling. And yet we've come to a point where we've hit the end of that story in so many ways. And you talk about it. You talk about quieting human cleverness as one of the essential tools that we need to use to innovate in a warming world with ever-growing conflicts for resources. So I just want to talk about that consciousness shift, that cognitive change that we're going to have to make that I think you speak around and to a lot. So I think the question is, how do we start to learn from an octopus, really?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I'll tell you a vision that just came into my mind, an image. I was doing a workshop with our company, Biomimicry 3.8. And there were a lot of people. There were about 90 people. We were outside. We were at picnic tables. And we were doing a design exercise. And we had sent them out, and they had brought back pine cones and lichen and shells and feathers and bones and all these amazing things. And we had them in the centers of the table, of the picnic table, and people were sitting across from each other with all of these life, these amazing things in front of them, and had were learning about them and feeling them and touching them. What do you think this is for? And all of that. I kept watching. They stopped looking at the artifacts, and they would look across at each other. And they were all had a design challenge they were trying to solve. And then they would start to say, well, you know, there is a place, I've seen a place in Denmark that does this. They have this really cool machine and it does this and it does that. And they started to talk about all the cool human things. Like, why don't we just solve it that way? The way we, you know, the coolest of the human things. And I literally would come over and gently take the back of their head and tip them back down to watch the artifacts again. And I kidded about it. I'm tipping the heads down. But that's what we're talking about. We have every inventor I know goes to the patent database to kind of get ideas, right? And there's inspiration boards. And you look at other magazines and you're like, what? You know, people go places on inspiration tours to try to see what other humans have done. We're very good at mimicking. Very good. But we forgot. You know, Aldo Leopold also calls it the circle of kinship, right? That we need to expand our circle of kinship and that we need to have a sense of we're not the first to have encountered these things. We're not the first ones to need to filter our wastewater. We're not the first ones to need to dissipate heat and cool ourselves in the summers. You know, we're not the first ones to need to find food and to, you know, they put these organisms put their kids to bed at night and they build nests. They build, right? They manufacture. They do chemistry, right? We forgot that we're not the first to do this. So the tipping of the heads is sort of this metaphor I have in my mind about one of the things that we do in biomimicry is the first step is quieting human cleverness. Now, it's not, believe me, the people that I study who have tried to mimic leaves are brilliant. Once you do the emulation, it's really, really a human creativity thing. You're looking at a spider and say, you know, my God, flies and crickets at one end, room temperature, and out comes a fiber five times stronger than steel weight for, you know, by weight. How do you do that? To understand that, to actually mimic it, that's where our humanness comes in. But what's interesting is that the people I know in biomimicry, the biomimics who actually do this work, they are in a constantly deepening conversation with the organism. It's hard to do, so they have to keep coming back. Now, that's something in Western industrial culture that we've fallen out of practice, to do this deepening conversation with the organism. And that respect is what's going to save us. It's not the technology. It's the change in attitude, in stance towards the rest of the natural world. There's a reason that biomimicry is relatively new for Western industrial culture, right? Like when you talk about all that you can learn, you know, a barge manufacturer comes to us and says, can you redesign our rudders? And they haven't redesigned a rudder or a propeller blade for 150 years. You know, they thought they said good enough. You know, we got really good at it. And then they realize that when you look at tuna or dolphins or penguins or flying organisms, anything that goes through fluid, and you look at the drag reduction strategies and the shapes that create that drag reduction, you realize that we stopped too early in optimizing. You know, life has a different shape that is like you would never have found it just by incrementally trying to do what we were doing.
So what I'm hearing is two things. This essential gestural movement from hubris to humility that is a spiritual posture, actually, dare I say it, but it is also a practical thing for us to do because it is an orientation away from our purely cerebral problem-solving mind down into kinship, as you said. It's sort of innovation through kinship with the living world. And I hear that. And then just in the background, in sort of like thinking about human history and human evolution, there was a split in the Enlightenment from folk stories and witchcraft and animism and the sort of woo-woo part of soft human connection to the animate and living world, a break from religion, because there was something religious there. There was the sort of mystical mythopoetic that snuck in with all these other human stories about how we belong to it all. We cut ourselves off from it in a kind of, I would say it must be necessarily so for our own cognitive development, and the age of science reigned supreme. And there was this need in Western culture to really separate from those mythical belongings and those stories. But when you talk, I can hear a reweaving that is robust. I mean, as you said when we started the phone call, how cool to be alive in this moment where our analytical, rational, engineering brains got us this technology. And maybe this is the moment where we fuse the sophistication of the technology we've developed, which we also know has dug us into the hole we find ourselves in. Maybe this reposturing, this orientation towards an innovation from a kinship with nature and a humility, maybe this is the exact moment we needed to come to so that those two parts of ourselves could fuse and we could find a way to that emergent future.
May it be so. May it be so. There has never been such a pull towards having us understanding that we're heading for this evolutionary knothole. And so we're kind of open now to solutions from somewhere else besides our own heads, right? And at the same time, science has come to the point where we are able to stare very, very deeply into nature's eyes. And while we see through a glass darkly still, I think, you know, there's so much more to learn. We have learned quite a bit now about how nature works or miracles, and how good for us to realize that. Learning about it is one thing. Learning from it, just it's a small shift. But if we were to start doing that right now, because we have learned about the natural world for so long now, all we're saying is shift to getting out your notebook with humility and saying, can we now learn from this? Right now, I'm writing a book on nature's universals. I'm looking at the things that organisms have in common and that patterns and phenomenon in the natural world that go across the tree of life and that go from molecular scale all the way up to biospheric, these principles. And it's thrilling. The only way I could do that is that we've had this era of big data and science, and you know, it has brought us to this point. At the same time, we are braiding indigenous knowledge, which has been looking at those patterns in place and understanding those patterns. And the scientists I talk to, so many of them say that these principles that are coming out are also principles that are in the deep wisdom traditions. I think that when we, you know, when you referenced when we left the bodily self, right? We had that mind-body split, and the divine feminine was basically associated with that flesh. And so there was this very deliberate demoting, desacralizing of the divine feminine, which was synonymous with earth. And that allowed us, think about it, allowed us, you know, Francis Bacon, who's the beginning of the scientific revolution, said we must torture nature for her secrets. That allowed us to begin to dig into nature's bowels, to the mother's bowels, right? And begin to mine and begin the Industrial Revolution also. Right? Like that mindset allowed us to do that. Now, the mindset that brings us back to respect and reverence, and it's a very practical respect. Because as I was saying, I mean, I could talk to you all day about the incredible technologies, both at, you know, the form technologies and process chemistries and also system level technologies that we're coming out with in biomimicry. It's very practical, but it comes out of, you first have to break the trance and you have to break the, you know, the myth, the lonely myth that we are not nature. And that somehow our technologies are different and could learn nothing from these, from this world, right? Yeah. It's a lonely myth. We're ready to come home. And we can. And we can. We belong here. You know, and I've watched this. Like, I wanted to write about life, so I took a full-on English literature, four-year English literature degree in addition to a five-year science degree. And my senior thesis was to look at our relationship to the rest of the natural world as depicted in literature from the ancient Greeks to now. Yeah. So I've been on this journey for a long, long time. And that's why I know an inflection point when I see it, you know?
So, oh my God, I'm just like, for those who can't see me, just quietly crying here, listening to, it's also this race, like we are destroying the living world at such pace and scale. So the grief is just immense. And of course we're destroying each other and ourselves. They mirror one another, the destruction of our planet so that we can have iPhones. We're caught in all these double binds. And really just the thought of being humble students of this miraculous multi-billion-year-old R&D project called Planet Earth that we could learn from her and that we could change our posture. It's so profound and yet, of course, requires a maturity that I hope we are able to get to as we witness these multiple crises. But maybe if you could talk a little bit more about the evolutionary knothole.
It's unnatural not to feel grief right now in the face of all of this. But it's also, I think, there was a time when we paid attention to our biological responses to things as a survival skill, right? So now we've dampened that down so much. Most of us have, and you let it come. But most of us have, you know, we drink some water from a city. It tastes like chlorine. It's not good for you. And your biological cells are probably screaming like, whoa, could we find another water source? Don't put that in here. But we say no to those cells. You know, it's kind of like, you know, it's the quieting of the divine feminine, right? It's nope. That's a biological, you know, response that is, I'm not going to listen to, right? You're listening to it because you're like, something's happening. We're heading towards this evolutionary knothole. I think about it as like a piece of driftwood. I must've seen a piece of driftwood at one point. I had a knothole in it, you know, walking the beach and all the fibers from the driftwood were heading into that knothole. And I thought, yeah, you know, I know enough as a scientist who's been looking at this for a long, long time. The thing that, you know, gives me the grief, but also gets me up in the morning. What gives me the grief is to know that not everybody's going to make it through that knothole. Not all of my beloved organisms, from the ones that I knew so well in my backyard ravine and to the ones that I visit every day in the wilderness here. I know not all of them are going to make it. And that is a pain, a deep pain. That's also a motivating fire, a fierceness that comes. But I know some of us will. And then we're going to bloom on the other side. The question is, what are we going to take with us? And how are we going to do it differently when we bloom on the other side? And I don't mean going up, forgive me, Elon Musk, going up to Mars. I don't mean that. I mean staying here. And, you know, Earth 2.0, let's see how we can be here. I hope that knothole gets bigger and bigger and bigger as we learn to respect these organisms and we take most of them with us. But yeah, I'm heading there, right? And that's what I do with my grief. I head there, one step in front of the other.
Yep. So, okay. you know, I spoke with Nora Bates and recently we were talking about the meta crisis and she's like, oh, with your cute Australian accent, I heard the meadow crisis, which was great. So how does, say, studying a meadow help us design for future cities?
You know, it's interesting you say meadow because my partner and I moved to this land. It was land we could afford 34 years ago. And it was 100% spotted, Russian spotted knapweed. It was a invasive weed. The land had been trashed by horses, too many horses on too little land. And so we got to experience being part of a healing team on a piece of land, on an 8-acre piece of land, and bringing it back to riparian area, brought back and bringing it back to native grasses. And we learned how that worked, how to be on that healing team, how to help the helpers. Anyway, so the meadow that you ask me about, you know, I'm looking right now out at the pasture of native grasses and forbs. And it went from being an incredible biological desert, in a sense, it was a monoculture of plants that were allelopathic. They actually put out poisons in their roots and so kill everything around them. And they usually don't take over, but here they had no predators. They had no parasites or pests and to keep them in check. And so when the land tipped into a degraded state, they were able to take over. So it was a monoculture. And now after 34 years of, it actually took about 12 years to turn around. It's incredibly diverse. And what once was dust-like, you know, you'd walk in and almost need a respirator because you'd kick up clouds of dust. It was just unbelievable. And now it's just rich, putting black soil and birdsong and insects and birds. You know, we just had 125 elk come through on their way to their wintering grounds. And we had six trumpeter swans, which are highly, highly endangered organisms, land in the pond that we had two ponds that had no open water. And we figured out how nature wanted to bring those back as well. And it's quite a journey. But what you find is that this system is so rich and so fertile and so full of life that what it does is export life to other places. I mean, it's that rich and abundant. I'll give you an example of it. One morning, we're always planting trees, and we were watering them. We were bucket watering them. And we looked down, and we were putting our bucket in, and there were just tens of thousands of these wriggling organisms. And we're like, what the heck are these? And in the water, they were tadpoles. And then on the shore, there were all these tiny, like penny size toads. And so we just sort of backed away and went, oh my God, oh my God. And we started walking back and they were everywhere. And they turned out to be, we had a wildlife biologist come by and he was so excited because he said, these are Western toads. And they're down to only 10% of their habitat in Montana. And you have so many on your property right now. And this was the same year that we had the six trumpeter swans. This is 8 acres. It's not that big a place. But that land and the wetlands had come back to the point where those nutrients, those toads were going elsewhere. That beneficial flow was flowing somewhere else. And there were all kinds of herons feeding, and those herons were bellies full of toads flying away to bring those nutrients to another habitat. The thing about ecosystems is that they're generous, meaning that water that comes into our habitat, it's healthy enough now that that water gets cleaned before it gets sent downstream. Air that comes in, if it's polluted, it gets cleaned. The trees and shrubs and grasslands clean it. Send it down to our neighbors cleaner than when it came in. There's soil being built. There's nutrients being cycled. There's this cooling that happens that was never happening before all this life came in. Those are called ecosystem services. The UN calls those ecosystem services. There's 21 of them. Other things that these ecosystems do for us. And that's what a city should do. And I think this gets us into sort of what is the next, for me, what is the next step for our human species? And it's to learn to be in those systems, of those systems, and to give back to those systems. And that, we call it generous design. That is not something we have asked of our buildings. Imagine asking of a city to give away as much goodness as the forest next door does. To have that be what a city sets itself to do. You know, to not have just a clean river so that we can swim in it, but to turn that around to say, we send water downstream cleaner than it came. We are cleaning air not just to reduce asthma rates in our city, which it will do, but we want the city next door to have their asthma rates be reduced. That's a very different way of seeing a design challenge.
We have to level up. So first of all, everyone listening, you are welcome. Janine Benyus, overlaying our cities as living systems. And this is real systems thinking. This is whole systems thinking. Inputs and outputs that are generous and that are life-giving and that are a part of the fabric of life on this planet. That I love the idea of being on the healing team. My hand is up, I'm on the healing team, and that's our job. And that we can think like this, it's like love. It's like you wouldn't make a family and think, how can it be the most toxic inputs and outputs possible so that it's not so that it crushes and kills our children and grandchildren's futures. You wouldn't think that way. And our context, as you said, is the planet Earth. So there is no away. My inputs are your outputs. And on and on and on.
That's right. But imagine when we say there's no away, we do it in the context of toxic waste. We're like, well, there is no away for our plastics, our forever plastics, right? What if we thought about everything that we gave away was goodness? We gave away nutrition. We gave away nutrients. What if the things that we make, the plastics that we make, the textiles we weigh, that we don't recycle all of them, let's get honest with ourselves. Those that leak into the environment should be food. They should be nutrients. They should enrich the place, right? Just like those Western toads, they're hopping through my property and they're going to go enrich somebody else's, right? Somebody else's place, because that's what ecosystems do. That's a whole different way of thinking for Western industrial humans right now, but it's probably the largest life lesson. Life creates conditions conducive to life. So I got really, and our whole team, we got really serious about that when our corporate clients came to us and said, how would you create a biomimetic city? We work with giant engineering firms who are doing all the infrastructure, the London Olympics, and, you know, so they're doing huge projects. And it's like, your projects right now are being judged by not a standard like this. What if we judged them by how many ecosystem services they produce? And let's get our standard from the wildland next door, because that's where you are. You're in a very particular place on the planet. And this system is your teacher. And it's also now nature, not just model, but nature as measure. You're going to measure yourself against the Emerald Standard. We call it Project Positive. We actually are working with Microsoft and Ford and Kohler and Interface and Google. And we're building a lot right now. We're building a lot.
Which is thrilling, of course. And it gets me to really, like, I have 7 million questions for you, but I'm just going to ask you one more, because obviously there are the inner landscape of human beings. And when you talk about corporations, I think about greed, human greed, the fact that it's never enough. for us. I don't know where we're trying to get to. I think we're just trying to get to love and connection. But, you know, money gets in the way and the economy. So I know this is a big question and I don't know if you've answered it anywhere, but I really wanted your thoughts. Can the economy mimic a living system? And if so, how?
It sure should. It needs to. I think, you know, I have somebody that I have tea with on the phone often, and we're still trying to figure out what is money in the natural world, because money's a proxy. It's a proxy. It's an IOU. That doesn't happen. It's a barter economy out there in the natural world. It's a service economy, mutualisms. It's a gift economy. It is definitely a care economy. When I say life creates conditions conducive to life, these organisms are living in such a way, you know, what do we call success in the economy? That needs to be reevaluated. So success in the natural world is, will my genetic material still be in the gene pool 10,000 generations from now? So basically, it's the continuation of life is success. And how do you reach it as an organism? Because you're not going to be there to take care of your offspring 10,000 generations from now. How do you ensure that? It's not through stock portfolios. What they've learned to do is to take care of the place that's going to take care of their offspring. That's really interesting. It's the economic goal is different for us. I mean, the criteria for success.
The criteria for success, yes, the outcomes of the economy. So the economic system or the economic story, it has to change rapidly to answer the questions that you are posing, which is, I mean, we're not even perceiving of ourselves as living organisms in living systems. Like, that is not the outcome for us. The outcome for us is a Porsche. Not like the sustenance and nourishment of life on Earth, ours included. And I'm like really keen to think about more with you and with anyone listening here about how all of the systems we're in can be conducive to life, can be, I love the description of your farm and the idea of Isabella Tree's farm. I love these magical lily pad islands of aliveness where whole ecologies can come and get rest and nourishment and go on and continue. So their inputs and outputs are so alive that it promotes more life. And that's really why we're here. And I'm through this podcast, through the work at the Academy that we're doing, through the work that you're doing and all of our communities knowing about each other, we start to create those bridges and links between those islands of aliveness. And we're on the healing team, so we need healing networks of aliveness so that we can kind of pulse and remind each other what that is and what that looks like and where to orient. Because if you're in a city, like I'm in Melbourne, you're kind of like, the signals you get, the reminders you get are very distracting. It's just very distracting. And we don't get to drop into why we're here. And you wake up and you're 50 and you forgot what the context was and why we're here. So I feel like your work is such a massive orientation and it's such a key to how we lean into these emergent futures. And maybe just share a few of the things that you're working on, because you're doing so much, but it would be worth people understanding how it's gone from the theory to the practice to the, yeah.
We do it little project by little project. And so if you've got a balcony and you've got plants out on your balcony and you plant milkweeds that are going to be helpful to monarch butterflies, you're part of it. And I work with these large corporations and we do the, you know, Project Positive basically says, can you take a data center or a something that is, you know, usually just, you know, turrets and bright lights and razor wire around this really sterile place. Can you make that part of the healing? Can you make it create ecosystem services? And you do that by design, right? So you're doing green roofs and blue roofs. You're certainly not doing asphalt parking lots. You know, you're doing permeable pavements, so you get water storage and you're planting incredible habitat support. But you're also doing your building in ways that sequesters carbon. You're using carbon sequestering concrete. You're using mass timbers. You're creating habit texture. You're creating breeding places, nesting places for organisms on your walls. Every surface becomes an opportunity to give back, right? And to welcome in life and to clean air and to clean water. The water getting through your site is getting cleaned by your site. We worked with HOK on a project. It's the U.S. Coast Guard building outside of D.C. It was going to be two big towers. We worked with them and they said, what's important to you? Water. Let's clean water. And it was on a sloped site. So now the building is a building that basically has all of these terraced roof lines. Think big terrace. When you fly over, it looks green. And it's a series of green and blue roofs. Everybody's got a great view in the building, by the way. But what happens is that the water comes in, and we used beaver as our model organism. So we looked at watersheds and we said, you know, beaver ponds are different when they start, when the water is up high and it's getting cleaned. So we changed each of the roof lines to have a different kind of wetland habitat. So the water comes in, goes over the roof lines. The roof lines are all connected, goes down to a big lake that was going to be their parking lot. It's not. It's a big lake. The whole community can use that lake. The water is cleaner because the building, the whole building, is a water purification device. That can happen, right, bit by bit by bit. And we say to our clients, why not get all of your employees to produce ecosystem services in their backyards? Give them a kit to be able to do it. How about your customers? That's pixelated healing. It's bit by bit by bit. You connect those bits together, you start to get ecological function back by design.
I love it. So Janine, just for the fun bit, can you tell us a couple of the innovations that have come out of, is this the accelerator?
Yeah, the Rea Hope Accelerator. Well, a couple of years ago, there's something called Green Pod Labs. And this is a company, it's based in India. The CEO had come over to the United States and was a plant chemist. So he knew all about, you know, the latest in plant chemistry and how much plants are constantly signaling to each other. And then he read that in his home country of India, that more than 50% of the produce that comes in from farmers' fields on the trains, but they're losing all of this because the trains are not refrigerated. I guess we could refrigerate trains, but that's not happening. And, you know, that's normally what we do, right? Like, let's just throw more fossil fuels at it. Knowing what he knew about plant signaling, he created these sachets that he mimicked the chemicals that plants naturally emit to help other plants beef up their defenses. He mimicked those chemicals. He puts them into a sachet. So you come as a farmer and he's actually sold right now. He's got 400 customers that are all integrators. So they're farmer cooperatives. And basically you put a sachet into these bushels and it's 40 to 80% less spoilage. That's a huge, huge thing. Because if you think about food waste, they say that, you know, if food waste was a country, it would be the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases because of all the methane. You know, it's amazing. It doesn't change the taste, which is super important, obviously, right? But you have these avocados that normally, you know, after 3 days are going and they're making it to market. That was Green Pod Labs. There's another one called Aquamidate that basically has, you know, you talk about filtering of water. We filter water in all kinds of ways. Let's just look at desalination. We take 900 pounds per square inch of pressure to push water against a membrane, and then we wonder why it gets clogged. But that's what we do with desalination plants. That's why they're so energy hungry. What Aquamidate has done is it's looked at this very simple channel protein, this pore in all of our cells, mostly in red blood cells, that escorts water through, leaving everything else behind. It is called forward osmosis. That's what life does. That's what you're doing right now in all of your cells. They're pulling water molecules through and keeping everything else behind. So they created these membranes, and then they found a way, by studying diatoms, they found a way to actually stabilize these in membranes. It's 100 times more permeable, these membranes, and at a fraction of the energy use, almost no energy use, because the water's being pulled through. These are huge. You know, we should all be talking about them constantly instead of, you know, Kim Kardashian's latest move.
Stop it. No, don't stop it. It's so, so cool. We might be surrounded by genius on this planet, but I am literally having a conversation with a genius, Janine Benyus. Thank you so, so much for all that you do and for all that you are.
Thank you, Barry.
I mean, wow. I kind of think after a conversation like that, I can hang my hat up. My work here is done. Janine Benyus has been one of my heroes for most of my adult life, and Danny's too. To have the privilege of talking to her and to learn from one of the great human beings on this planet right now, that's the first part of the privilege. The second part is to learn that the greatest mentor, the ultimate genius, is all around us in nature. It's just a gift that keeps on giving, and that I just want to bow at the foot of the great oak tree outside my window and listen and learn and be quiet my human cleverness more. I hope you all found that as enriching and thrilling and full of hopeful possibilities as I did and I do. And go well into your day, into your sleep, into your dreams, and dream of a generous, generative future, because it's all possible. We just need to bow our heads in reverence.
This was the Wisdom in Action podcast, brought to you by the Small Giants Academy. If you want to turn this wisdom into action, go to smallgiants.com.au for more information about the programs we run. We love hearing from you. So tell us what you think by leaving a rating and review on your favorite podcast app, or email us at podcast@smallgiants.com.au.